Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to the Percussion Loft, the podcast from Gonbops, the leading percussion instrument manufacturer since 1954. I'm Rich Mangiacaro. So glad you could join us as we hear from the world's greatest drummers and percussionists. Let's get started. Our 15th episode on the Percussion Loft features award-winning drummer percussionist Bernie Dressel. Bernie is one of music's biggest forces in keeping big band music not only alive, but also fresh and current. His band, the BBB, featuring Bernie Dressel, is one of LA's most exciting large jazz ensembles, and Bernie's approach is fiery and powerful. Bernie Dressel has performed with Maynard Ferguson, Gordon Goodwin's Big Fat Band, and played and recorded for 15 years for Grammy winner Brian Setzer. He's been voted best big band drummer numerous times in both Modern Drummer and Drum. Bernie is also one of the busiest film session artists in Los Angeles, having played on highly popular film scores including Jurassic Park, American Sniper, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, Bourne Supremacy, Star Trek, and Incredibles 2, just to name a few. He's also been busy playing on hit TV shows including Family Guy and The Simpsons, and recently on a new streaming show, Muppets Mayhem. Here's my conversation with Bernie Dressel. That was a track from the BBB featuring Bernie Dressel, from their album Burn 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 called Zoot Suit. And we're going to be hearing a lot more of his music throughout the show today, not only from that record, but also from the new album called The Pugilist. That's the correct pronunciation, right, Bernie?
That's right.
Yeah, good. So welcome, man. Welcome to the Percussion Loft.
I have to punch you if you pronounced it wrong, because a pugilist is someone that fights with their fist.
I know.
Yeah.
I actually looked that up this morning. And,
okay.
Yeah, I was going, okay, what does that mean?
So I had. I'm educating the world.
Yeah. So I looked at. Are you a boxing fan?
Well, no. I mean, a little bit. Like as a kid, watching Muhammad Ali and all those fights with Howard Cosell and the wide world of sports. Yeah, a little bit, right. I guess. Yeah, not avid. Yeah.
When did that album get released?
Oh, let's see. Burn, Burn, Burn was, let me get this right. 90, oh gosh. Now I forget. It's hard. The years go by. 98.
Okay.
1998. No, sorry. 98. 2018.
Okay.
Wrong decade at first.
Okay. And what about the
2018.
Pugilist? What about
Pugilist, the Pugilist? We say the thing about Burn, 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 what you just heard, that was recorded at Capitol Records with the horns, and the drums were done at Sunset Sound by me alone first. So that was the way that was recorded in the studio. But the Pugilist we recorded during COVID. And that was released in 21 now, the end of 2021.
Yeah.
So we recorded it during COVID, and it was emotional to finish that thing as we're all cooped up. And so, and I spent so much time on it, gathering everyone, all the musicians sent me their tracks individually. And I started Yeah, again with drums first, and then added lead trumpet, and then add some keyboards, then added second trumpet, then added alto sax. So that the recording process was so unique and different, and actually leads to me recording, you know, half the recording I do now is probably at from my home studio, and the other half is in bigger sound stages and other studios. Yeah. So yeah,
I mean that band is so great. It's such a great band. I've only seen you guys once. No, twice actually. Twice.
Okay.
One of the times was at that. Remember that club at the Santa Monica Airport?
I do remember it. It was called Typhoon.
That was a cool place.
Yeah, very cool, and they had weird things on the menu along with good, you know, like Thai food. And
I remember
but
that.
The club itself was so supportive of music, and it was a great place to play. Yeah,
it was. Yeah. So listen, man, let's I want to go back a little bit and talk a little bit about your early days. So small town Pennsylvania.
Yeah, Sharon, Pennsylvania. Sharon, PA, the signs say as you approach it.
And what major city is that close to?
Semi-major, right over the Ohio border. I mean, it's right on the border, is Youngstown, Ohio.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But Sharon, you know, in that area, and it's about an hour north of Pittsburgh, about 2 hours west of Cleveland, 2 hours south of Erie. But that whole area is big with football, like Joe Namath's from the neighboring city. I think Montana is too, but Marino is definitely. So it's a big football area, but a very good, you know, small town and area music, you know, for rock and jazz. And so it was a good place to kind of, to definitely grow up, you know, as a kid through high school. I was there.
What was the early spark for drumming? Was it, what was the first kind of, I want to do that.
Yeah, the very unique story of only unique, maybe not unique, but that I was 2 years old, but the very unique story that I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan.
Yep.
So, you know, as a 2 year old, I'm literally, you know, two and a third. And, you know, television is big to a kid when they see it at that age. You know, we get hooked on it. Right when I turned two is when John F. Kennedy was shot in November of 63. And that was huge because I just as a 2 year old, I sensed sadness and my parents pointing to the TV saying, you know, he's not alive anymore. Trying to explain that to a 2 year old from a black and white television where they're showing a clip of Kennedy talking at a speech, even though he had passed away. And so I was confused. Well, if he's dead, how am I looking at him on that screen? But I sensed that sadness. Then 4 months later, February 64, Ed Sullivan, the Beatles, that, you know, 90 degree or 180 degree turn of happiness, elation, joy, people screaming, the Beatles having fun, playing great. So not just Ringo, but the whole band, that feeling of, wow, this is special and that's fun and good. And that got me going, I guess. And then listening to Elvis after that, really, and trying to be Elvis with a toy guitar or pounding on garbage cans in the backyard or at my grandma's house on pots and pans. Yeah,
it's the same exact thing for me. Actually, I was seven.
Yeah,
I was 7 years old when I saw.
Oh, you're
Ringo.
Old. You're old.
I'm old. Yeah, but at the same time, the Lucy show was on, and I remember seeing you know the Cuban band, and I was like, like watching those guys going, oh, look at the congas, and I was all excited about hand drumming and playing on crap, you know, and so yeah, same for me too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I saw the Lucy show too, or actually, what was it called? Wait, there was the Lucy show. There was Lucy.
I love Lucy
was the first one. Yeah.
Right.
With Babalu. But, you know, before I forget to tell you in this interview, I don't know if you remember this or if I, but so I got a set of congas in 1975 when I was, so what is that, like freshman in high school or eighth grade. I wanted for Christmas some gum bops.
Oh, really?
And they were, I don't have them here at the house. They're in cartage. I have the newer models at the studio here at my home studio. But that old, they were like red mahogany, but I had the King Tumba, the biggest one, I believe it was. And then whatever, I guess it was just the Conga that was the second from the top size. But ordered them online, I guess, was looking at them. And so did I know how to play them? Not really, but I could use my hands. But then fast forward 4 years later on those congas that, did I have them? Yeah, I might have taken them to Eastman. I went to college in Eastman School of Music in Rochester, New York. And but I started studying there with one of the upperclassmen that could play. Because I thought, I better be well-rounded. I mean, I've always been like the big fish in the small pond in Sharon, PA. But who knows, as you go into, you know, the bigger world, you know, the grown-up boys and girls, you know. So I started learning real conga technique there from him. And he even brought it, his name's John Arucci. He lives in New York City. But he brought in Frankie Malabé.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know. He was teaching, I don't know what it was called, New York Drummers Collective or something like that.
Right.
But he would come into Rochester then and occasionally do some teaching. And so I got to study with him too.
Oh,
even though John Arucci was a very good teacher and I learned a lot technique and, you know, things to play. It was cool to be right next to Frankie and, you know, him show me how to get a better slap and et cetera. Yeah.
Did you study the classical stuff from John Beck?
I did, yeah. Wow. So, yeah, I'd always grown up from a kid. You know, my dad was a milkman, a barber, a bartender, like be well-rounded, different jobs, bring in different money, do different things. So along the way, you know, I was studying classical, you know, snare drum and timpani. Eventually mallet, you know, ninth grade, we got a marimba in the house and vibes. And, so I was studying, you know, I did hand percussion, different styles, like, obviously big band and jazz, but rock. Teaching. I was teaching when I was 15 years old to like 10 year olds.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. I was always doing different things. I studied alto saxophone from fourth grade, piano, seventh grade on, and theory. So it was always a cumulative of different things to be well-rounded, including teaching. So when I went to Rochester to Eastman, I went on a music ed degree. And then once I was there, I go, oh, I can get a double degree in performance too. So I did that. And since I was meeting the requirements of playing wise, you know, with the performance majors, so I did that too. And there was no drum set undergrad at Eastman when I was there, 79 to 83. So all the undergrad, there was a master's degree jazz program, so all the undergrads that were, you know, wanting to be jazzers too, or pop, or whatever you want to call it, rhythm section, we all did the bands too, you know, and did all the jazz stuff, but not towards a degree program. So that's where, like, I'm adding in hand percussion, going, I better do that too. And I enjoyed it, but I wanted to learn more about it. So I actually did that at Eastman, kind of off the curriculum. But yes, studied classical music percussion with John Beck.
Were you in high school? Did you were in the high school jazz band and all of that too?
Yeah, I mean, I think we called it a stage band,
right?
You know?
Yeah, right.
But at the time, for some reason, but yeah, we did jazz, and so, you know, usually, you know, you get to a school and the upperclassmen have that chair on drums, but I was able to play in the high school stage band when I was a freshman. But the other style I didn't mention, I was really into with my teacher also, rudimental drumming and drum corps and you know, that kind of thing, where I even did some competitions and was like national snare drum champion for my age group when I was 10 and 11 and 12 and 13. Yeah. I got tired of the competing thing and go, okay, I got to get ready for school. I got to play music, not just perfect a, you know, rundown of the rudiments or a performance piece all year to, you know, do this competition I would go to every year, a year at Notre Dame University. When I was that age. So, yeah, so I've had some different aspects of percussion, drumming, music.
Did you ever march on a drum corps?
Well, there wasn't one of the big, what they call junior corps, they were called, you know, for people up through high, you know, up to high school and even college age. I don't know what the cutoff is. There's a cutoff age. There wasn't one right near us at all in that area. So I eventually went up to Erie, which is a 2-hour drive to go play with the senior corps, which is more adult, the Erie Thunderbirds.
Oh, yeah, I remember. Because I was in the Syracuse Brigadiers, and we competed against the Erie Thunderbirds.
Oh, well, this was when I did that finally. I was, I guess, a junior in high school, and it was just my parents are so supportive of me and my brother, Jonathan Dressel, who's a drummer also.
Yeah.
Been 20 years on Jimmy Kimmel. He's been doing, he's 6 years younger than me, taller, not as good looking, but very good drummer. Yeah. I did that core with the senior core. I don't know, maybe 6 months, but it was just too much for my parents to keep driving me 2 hours one way, 2 hours back, plus wait for the rehearsals. So I stopped doing that, and also to prepare for marimba and timpani auditions at colleges, and went, okay, this is taking too much time. So, but the core stuff I did prior to that was a lot when I was 8 years old through 15. It was something in the area called NBTA. The National Baton Twirling Association. And then we'd have baton twirlers and color guard, drum line, and it wasn't bugles, it was trumpets were allowed, and it wasn't bugles. So we would do that, which was DCI, you know, junior corps and senior corps. It was this NBTA thing that was, you know, a lot of younger kids too involved with it.
So. Do you remember how old you were when you kind of remember when you first like had that like spark about big band stuff?
Big band. Well, like, yeah. So Beatles is 2. My dad tried to take me to lessons at 3. They said too young, 3.5, too young, 4, too young, 4.5. He kept trying. They go, okay, we'll give him a lesson. So at 4.5, I had my lesson. And after the lesson, my teacher at Mark's Music in Farrell, PA, where they're in Hermitage, PA now, still going strong, they said, hey, you should have brought him in earlier, you know, joking around, because I was a shy boy. And I was, you know, I listened very well to direction and wanted to please and do the right thing. So I was a good prospective student at that age of 4.5. So that's when I studied that. Now, what was your question, though? I got sidetracked there.
When the big band spark, yeah.
Right. So the Beatles records for me was what was happening, or these boots are made for walking, you know. Nancy Sinatra or some other 45s and stuff, the Monkees. But then getting my first Buddy Rich record when I was 8.5, which was Live at the Whiskey A Go Go.
Oh, yeah.
Which is recorded here in L.A. And it was a... You know, when I used to play with the Gordon Goodwin Big Fat Band for 15 years, and I told Gordon that was the first record. He goes, "Ah, you started with the worst one," and meaning it was more of a Buddy. You know, it was effective. He was trying to hit on the rock thing with that album, playing at a rock club, doing straight A, Buddy Rich straight A, I guess you would call it, with the big band to try to get in younger people that knew, you know, popular rock. Music, and like he even recorded Norwegian Wood, you know, famous for that, you know, as a swing 3/4, but a Beatles tune, you know. So that was the first record where I go, oh, a big band. So then we would go to my parents, again, so darn supportive the whole way with us. We would go to Idora Park in Ohio and see Buddy Rich there at the ballroom, Idora Ballroom there, Park Ballroom. Beautiful ballroom. And he would play. We'd go every year to see him there. And that was from as soon as I had that record, we were going every year. And then Maynard started to come in and they do double bills there. So that all got me going. And even that, what I said, that drum corps of NBTA, if for a while there, we even did where we played on the sideline for the Baton Twirlers with like 13 horns. And there was three drum set players that were like 17 years old, and I was 8 playing with them, and I was playing timbales.
Okay.
So that was kind of big bandy, but I wasn't playing drum set with them. And then pretty soon I moved up the ranks where, by junior or 10 years old, 12 years old, I'm playing with the 18-year-olds, playing gigs or concerts with all these guys that are older than me. So that was great. But that's the spark.
Did reading come easy to you when you were young?
Reading. Yeah, we started that on my first lesson. Rube, no, what was it? I can't think of the name. I used to know that my story about that, but book one, quarter notes,
Yeah.
page two, or with well, quarter notes and quarter rest. So, I was reading from the first lesson, and I guess I was always also mathematically inclined versus English and that in those subjects. But math was a I got that concept, and maybe also it worked from practicing reading that, the numbers of that and all the subdivisions and that counting bars, phrases that I mean, that's all we did was work on hands and reading
Yeah.
for, not drums. I never took a drum set lesson ever with my teacher. We always did reading and orchestral reading and rudimental studies and timpani too and mallets eventually. But so I've always been reading my butt off. Yeah, like that's like my second language after English. Reading notation.
You said something about saxophone, so you were also reading melodically at a young age, right?
Yes.
That
Yeah.
that's a big
So
deal.
that, yeah. I mean, I thought about, okay, I want to learn guitar so I can learn to write for, like, I had even bought some arranging books for piano and to learn about voicings and stuff because I was writing stuff for horns for my band that would do like Chicago and Funkadelic and in junior high and high school. So the Don Sebesky Arrangers book or whatever it's called. So yes, I wanted to learn about that. It wasn't like just, oh, you got to learn theory. That's part of the game. I was really interested in it. And but I also thought, well, let me learn guitar so I can learn to write for guitar. And then someone said, well, it's, other than the if you write a line like saxophone line, but usually most of it would be chord symbols
Right.
and slashes. Oh, I go, oh, so I don't have to learn to play the instrument to write for it. Okay, I got that. Okay, for writing. But
Yeah.
I never did really learn guitar. Yeah. And it's funny because now my big band, I try to separate from the other big bands. I'm not a writer in my big band. I get guys better than me to do that, write arrangements and tunes for the BBB featuring Bernie Dressel. And so I go, we're not going to have piano in my big band in the
Right.
BBB. So that'll be different. 98% of big bands have piano, might even be the writer, the arranger, or the leader of the band. But so I'm just going to have guitar, which kind of also is a tip of the cap to my days playing with Brian Setzer
Right.
with his big band, the Brian Setzer Orchestra, which has basically been upright slap bass, guitar, drums, and 13 horns. And it used to have piano. He was trying to honor that tradition. And then he realized, I'm filling it up enough with guitar. I don't need the piano too. And so I've gone with my big band just to have guitar.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at Eastman, was there a stage band, jazz band that you were in as well?
Yeah, Eastman had, I don't know if that's still the case, they had four bands, 1, 2, 3, and 4. Huh, isn't that a good number for them? So, you know, you start in the fourth band, you work your way up and the third band, and then second band and first band is what I did over the years there at Eastman, yes.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, again, it's mostly undergrads not doing the degree program or that, but wanting to do it. Yeah.
Did Jonathan go to music school?
Well, he, like, I auditioned Eastman, now three schools, and now people audition 10. I don't know.
Yeah, right.
But I auditioned at Eastman, Cincinnati, which was not, it's the other side of Ohio, not really close to Sharon, PA. But Alan Audie was there with Black Earth Percussion Group, and I saw him at a PAS clinic and went, oh, he's great. I like it. Let me audition there. But that was, I didn't think they were known for their big bands there, but I auditioned there. And then I auditioned as the, on the final that I knew I'd get in is at Youngstown State University, which was good, but not at the level of those other ones. So Jonathan, 6 years later, he auditions at Eastman, Miami and Youngstown. So he did Miami audition there.
Okay.
And he got accepted to all of them like I did. And he picked Miami, which was, did have an undergrad jazz drum set program. Eastman, again, off the curriculum, you do it. But they just gave him such a great, almost, I think, just about full scholarship, that it was hard to turn that down and being such a great music school. Even though he got accepted at Eastman too, he chose Miami.
Right, right, right.
Yeah, which is a great, great music
school. Oh, yeah, it's great.
The first two Eastman percussion instructors, now I'm forgetting who the first guy was, but I think they both did 40 years or 50. Except for 45, something like they were, the two of them were like 90 years at Eastman.
Wow.
You know, so yeah, John Beck is a, you know, a legend and a gentleman, and you know, one of his strengths as a teacher was just his open to what you were maybe going to specialize in. Like, he would teach Lee Howard Stevens, going to be a marimba player. Duncan Patton's going to be a marimba. Chris Lamb going to do excerpts, and you know, he's principal percussionist with, you know, New York Phil now, or me and Roland, drum set. Patsy Dash, you know, she was my classmate. She's Chicago Symphony, you know, playing a lot of Piatti, you know, specialist
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
But he would let us specialize, yet still make sure we're covering all the bases. It's like my dad, like, make sure you can do everything, you know, and but also knowing that, you know, you do have your thing you're going to put more time into and kind of specialize in, maybe, yet still be well-rounded. So for me, you know, as I'm known as a drum set player, you know, from playing gigs that way over the years, but in the studio, you know, half of my stuff is orchestral percussion or hand percussion,
right,
in a section or by myself. So again, well-rounded, that I can work more and do more things. And that kind of comes from my dad, but it also comes from John Beck, you know, that idea of that yeah. I took from him too.
As you were ending your career at Eastman, and were you seeing the focus more and more aiming towards the big band thing? And then, because I know after Eastman, you went pretty soon after that to Los Angeles, right?
Yeah, right away, you know, half a summer, and then I moved in August to L.A. right after graduating, right. Wait, what was the question, though, again?
As you were getting close to completing your college studies, was the focus to big band getting stronger?
Focus. And... So no, okay. I was, like, your senior year in a music ed degree, you're student teaching. You're actually there more than you are at school. But now, like, for instance, Roland and I, you know, when we would play in the orchestra or the Eastman Wind Ensemble, you know, Eastman Wind Ensemble would have more percussion to play. There's more to do. The orchestra stuff could be that you don't even play on a movement or a piece, or you just play one cymbal crash.
Right.
You know, stereotypical cartoon of the guy counting 201, 202, yeah. You know, and then missing, you know, worried he's going to miss the crash. But so when we had pieces like that assigned, we try to go, hey, Patsy, do you want to do that Piatti? I'm going to go play a gig instead. And she's like, sure, Bertie. and Roland and I would be off doing drum set gigs. So, and not big band necessarily. I was playing like a kind of a lounge. Well, I call it a lounge, but we were doing like all the top 40 hits, you know, with a quartet or quintet, you know. And so I was, I guess you could say, studying pop music just by doing it and playing gigs, you know, the old street way of learning. And so it wasn't really, I wouldn't call it focusing big band, but yes, every year at Eastman, where I was playing in a jazz ensemble, and that was, you know, always part of it. But like when I teach privately from my home, but I also taught at UNLV for, I don't know how many years, 10? I lost track, but I would fly to Las Vegas and fly home in the morning and fly home at night, teach like 12 hours or 10 hours. But with my students, I'm always like saying, we're going to be well-rounded. We're going to learn all kinds of groups. We're not going to just learn jazz. You're not going to just learn John Bonham. We're going to learn all that, because you never know what's going to get thrown at you in any musical situation. Again, like being prepared for anything, but also, you know, it could be different things on the same, like when I do Family Guy, it could be where I have to sound like Neil Peart right. For a thing, or another time where we're playing big band, or another time a country two beat, you know, or whatever. So I make sure that we learn the instrument, the drum set, when I'm giving drum set lessons, about, you know, the way to play what you already know, how you can play it better. If you know rock beat number one, let's find a way to play rock beat number one better. And then, you know, the basic swing feel, what that really means, and different ways to do it, but ways that I think are maybe the best choice possibly on certain ways of playing the drum set. But different styles, and because jazz is not just swing. It could be, you know, Pancho Sanchez, Latin jazz, or Weather Report, you know, or rock, jazz rock.
That's right.
You know, with any groove can be jazz. So to just say, I'm studying jazz, right. You know, people tend to think big band swing, you know, right. Or whatever, but it's all groove.
So you instinctively knew when you were young that you had to be well-rounded. I mean, you knew that when you were young, and you kind of latched onto that aspect of being a rounded musician, you know, and mm-hmm. all the different variety that you do today is proof of all the different aspects of that, you know. So what was your first kind of big breakout gig? Was it when you finally moved out here, or... And who was it
that
with?
That first gig with the accordion player for a wedding in Sharon, PA.
Right,
that was big.
Yeah.
you're playing with, you know, adults and an accordion guy. Every wedding was polkas.
Yeah.
And where I grew up, you know, polka band. But let's see, breakout gigs. You know, your first pro gig when you moved to your city. So other than, you know, dumb gigs or whatever, you know, they're going to play with Maynard Ferguson.
Okay.
I guess people would consider that a big gig as opposed to
sure.
me playing with the Letterman, you know, pro gig. But Maynard, you go, oh, you know, you're one of the stars. You're not just the backup. You're one of the star player. You know, Peter Erskine has come before you.
Right.
You know, Danny D'Imperio. So there's, you know, you're in that lineage of that. So that was a big one.
Yeah.
But on a global scale, that would have to be Brian Setzer Orchestra and playing with Brian
right.
in his big band and the trios with him that people from South America know who I am or
yeah.
Europe because
right.
of Brian, you
right.
know. When I do record, you know, recording, you could go, well, what's the breakout gig for you in recording? And that would be, well, the first TV show I did was Our House. And it wasn't like, well, listen to me go to town on that thing. It was just that it was, you're in there, you know, and hoping that you do well and hold on to it. So, you know, I guess highlights would be someone go, oh, you do Family Guy, you know, because they like the show. They're, you know, they like that you played on that or whatever, or, oh, you did Incredibles too. Wow. You know, because there's a lot of featured drumming in that movie.
What was the catalyst to get into the session scene in L.A.? Did you have someone that recommended you?
Oh, right. Right. Because anything, like when you're starting from scratch, what's your first in?
Yeah.
You know, moving to L.A. just in general for gigs was a bass player I played at Eastman with,
yeah.
Rick Shaw. He moved here a year before me. And so he gave some numbers to call, some people to recommend me to, and some dumb rehearsals. Subbing for someone for the first set somewhere, you know, this kind of thing. But for Maynard, oh, yeah, yeah. Maynard, the catalyst to get into that, well, usually if you're coming out of college and other college guys are on it, that was kind of a way in. But I was playing locally in Newport Beach with some horn players and bass player Bob Wackerman.
Oh, okay.
Who is the one Wackerman brother that doesn't play the drums.
Right.
Yeah, he's playing bass. So I was playing gigs with him, and he kind of pulled me onto Maynard's gig. Now, into the session world, which is your question, is the writer, Joel McNeely, who does stuff with Seth MacFarlane now and other people, you know, for TV and movies and records. That was his first writing gig, and he went to school at Eastman with me.
Oh.
He was an upperclassman, saxophone player and writer. And so he, you know, he was nice enough to request me to kind of pull me in, you know, and that's a favor, really, too.
Yeah.
But, you know, that whole thing, oh, it's who you know. Well, it certainly doesn't hurt.
Right.
As long as they like you. Personally, right. Or also musically.
Sure.
Yeah. So that was like, wow. So I show up on the session, you know, I don't know what, 80 piece orchestra? I don't know how many then, maybe 60. And you're the new guy. And that everyone looks at you, you know, everyone's new to you, but everyone's looking at who's that?
Right.
You know,
right.
Who got him in here? And so they're kind of watching you a little closer than if you're established, like, and like if there's any mistakes.
Yeah.
You know, nobody's perfect. We're human. So if you make a mistake early in the, or too many at first, they're going to go, uh-oh.
Right.
So there's more pressure at the beginning of that kind of thing. Now, if I make a mistake, you know, they know, you know, well, you know, you're batting 950.
Yeah,
he's
course.
Pretty good.
Of
you
course.
Know, he can, it's not going to be a problem. That's not the norm or yeah. They'll know a bit high batting average of
and then
nailing
did,
things.
How did Brian Setzer come to you?
So that's another different way in that, you know, Brian Setzer was the Stray Cats. He
right.
was a trio with a couple of his MTV, et cetera, from two of his buddies from high school or from where he lived in Long Island, put that together. So how's that connection happen? Well, I was playing smooth jazz. There was a part in my time where I was playing with different smooth jazz groups, maybe the Rippingtons for a little bit or Keiko Matsui quite many records with Keiko. And on with Keiko, there was a sax player, Mike Acosta. He, when I first joined her, he was the saxophone player. So he lived in Santa Monica, two doors down from Brian Setzer by chance. So they would have jam sessions, jazz bebop jam sessions, meaning Mike and some friends, not me, not Brian. And so they were playing one day and Brian walked by and go, hey, can I sit in with you guys? And they go, well, sure. You know, let me go get my guitar. And they're like, oh, this rockabilly guy is going to try and play tunes with us. And he came and held his own and played great. And like, wow, okay. And then Brian goes, you know, I always wanted to put a big band with the Stray Cats. Can we do that? Can you put that together for me, Mike? So Mike became kind of the MD contractor and he called me to do it. But then I could not do it because I was playing Latin jazz with Freddie Ravel at La Vallée. So I had to say, no, I can't do those two gigs. I'm already working. And because he's on this guy, Brian Setzer, who's, you know, Stray Cats, he's trying to do a couple big band gigs. So it's not like, hey, this is going to be big. So I stayed where I was, didn't do the gig. I think Dave Dirge was the drummer that did those two gigs. And then Brian did those two gigs. They went well enough and went, okay, let's do some more gigs. Brian says to Mike, who's that original drummer you asked that couldn't do it? Let's try him this time. And so I went in and did it. And I'm thinking to myself, what would Brian Setzer, I know big band. So what would Brian Setzer want in big band? I'm thinking, well, I bet you it's more along the Krupa thing or Stray Cats swing than it is Buddy Rich or Count Basie. I have a feeling it's a little more backbeat, four on the floor, dance, you know, sing, sing, sing. Let me approach it that way. Because if they're asking, I know Dave Durz is a great drummer. Why didn't they just ask him to do another one? So maybe Brian was looking for something different and Dave approached it conventionally, let's call it. So Brian came from that rockabilly thing. And so I did that and he liked the approach. And even for the first year or two, it was Brian being a little more polite on the guitar, Freddie Green staying out of the way, letting the band be a little quote unquote normal. And then he realized eventually that when he rocked out on guitar more, the fans liked it more, it went over bigger. And he started going, okay, I can just be me on the guitar, a la Stray Cats, and wrap the big band around that in a different way. So then he brought in a slap bass player, upright rockabilly slap, as opposed to the upright jazz bass we had at the beginning, just no slap. And so that changed my approach a little bit, where I didn't have to fill up the shuffle quite as much because now the bass is slapping the shuffle. But and then it grew from there and finally hit on all cylinders. You know, 92 is when we started. 98 is when the Dirty Boogie and Jump Jivin' Whale, 3 million records, it finally hit on all cylinders. And Yeah. And then, so it was cool being a part of that to establish kind of a new style in a way. Because one time, who was it that came, was brought, because he was going to produce, Jay Graydon.
Oh.
You know, great guitarist and producer. And so he was brought to a Brian Setzer gig maybe around 97 and said, here, maybe you're going to produce it. Come check it out. And then I guess the story is, I didn't hear him say it, like, what is that drummer doing? Like me, after doing the band for 5 years. And because it wasn't traditional big band. And he thinks I'm a bull in his china shop, probably, or something, compared to how Mal Lewis might have played big band, et cetera. Joe Jones, et cetera. So then he saw it a second time. He goes, oh, okay, I get it now. I see what it is. It's more of a blend of Krupa, 40s swing with 50s Elvis rockabilly with Keith Moon energy thrown in.
Exactly.
And something new and different. Yeah. It wasn't what he expected to see in the drum chair of a big band. So, but that's how I got that gig, indirectly through Smooth Jazz, of all things.
Right.
Because the sax player started to play with Brian. And the reason he got it is he lived two doors down from him.
Okay. And you had about six or seven years with him before you guys did the Woodstock in, was it 99?
Yeah, Woodstock 99 it was. Correct.
Yeah. So there was some time you guys developed that whole thing. And I've seen that video. It was killing. I mean, Rock This Town was so on fire. that band was so great at that show. What was that experience like?
Well, we were in Atlantic City the night before and playing a gig there and then hanging out at the bar or in the casino afterwards and left, I don't know, 2 or 3 a.m. to drive to. It wasn't actually in Woodstock, right? I don't forget where it was exactly, but a big field like that and, you know, 300,000 people, you know, so, oh my gosh, look at all this sea of people. And, but we got there about, you know, who knows, we were sleeping on the bus, 9 a.m. and we wake up. Okay. Some of us would take showers at this outdoor shower thing or, you know, whatever. And then we put on our, you know, whatever it was, leopard print jackets and went out there. And Willie Nelson played before us, and then Elvis Costello played solo before us, just him and a guitar. And his guitar didn't make it, so he borrowed one of Brian's Gretsch Hot Rod guitars. Oh. And then we went on after Elvis Costello, and it was exciting. But they were recording it, and you knew this is kind of a historic concert, you know. And it was being, pay-per-viewed all over the world. And so as we play Rock This Town, that has the drum solo in it, for instance, contained 32 bar solo, but, you know, what is that, a minute? I don't know. Right. But I'm thinking, all right, if I've ever played a drum solo in my life, this one's going to be seen a lot.
Yeah.
And you get one take at it. In fact, when we recorded the album, we always did first takes. So even doing the drum solo on Rock This Town on the Dirty Boogie album, I'm thinking, you know, we're playing live, me, Brian, and the bass player. The horns were overdubbed on that record. But I'm thinking, you know, if Brian's happy with his take, he doesn't go, Bernie, you okay? Or do we need to punch in the drum solo? He's just like, great. So I knew, like, in these two situations, the actual recording of the album and Woodstock, I go, these are big, and I can't get a second crack at them if something goes wrong, you know. So, or I'm not happy with it, whatever. It has to be good. So, you know, and you still have to go for it. Take chances a little bit to a point.
Sure.
But, and then the band has to come in properly out of your drum solo, too. Can't throw them off, you know, where they're coming wrong. So... but it all went well. It was exciting. And afterwards, I remember Brian and I, he liked baseball. I like baseball. We were playing catch with a baseball, me and him, you know, throwing. Well, I forget who was on after us. I don't know. Seven Dust? I don't know. But so we're playing. Then we go, okay, let's get on the buses. All right, we get on the bus. we had some feed on the bus of the concert. We see it finishing. It was the third day, but and the Chili Red Hot Chili Peppers are the last to go on. They're playing Fire by Hendrix, and people are starting to set things on fire and riot. So it was, and we're not there. We're watching it on TV. Going, oh my gosh, you know, what the heck, you know? And so that didn't end well because people were upset that there weren't enough bathrooms. There was not good water. Meaning it was hard. You have to give up your spot to go get a water. It was so hot. And they were charging an arm and a leg for a water at that point. 1999, where they charged $16 for a little water bottle. I don't know, but people were mad, so they were going nuts at the end. And
yeah, I remember that
retelling. Yeah. Yeah, so we weren't quite there for that, but we were part of that whole thing, and so it was historic in that sense.
Yeah, yeah. So you, so yeah, after that event, that you were still with Brian for another what, 7+ years?
Yeah, before... I quit. Yeah, I quit in beginning of 2007. So that was 15 years with Brian.
Was that because you were just getting so busy in Los Angeles that was doing sessions, it was just time to stay at home and work more or less?
There was different reasons, but 15 years, I thought that's long enough.
Yeah.
And move on to something else because, you know, yeah, at the height of the Dirty Boogie, we're on the road 6 months out of the year. Yeah. So people think you're gone all the time, even though you aren't. But in general, we'd be on the road 3 to 4 months on those other 14 years. And still, people would get confused how much you're really gone. Like Maynard, they tore 40 weeks out of the year.
Yeah.
But, you know, Brian, that was, what is that? You know, 3 months is 13 weeks. So we tore maybe 16 weeks out of the year, except for that 1 year. So there's still plenty of weeks to go do sessions. But still, the impression is you're on the road. And I thought, let me establish I'm back in town.
Yeah.
To make sure there's no confusion. I know when I did Maynard for 9 weeks, someone from, I don't know who it was, I forget, Zildjian or something, or Vic Firth, they said, you know, it was 3 years after I quit Maynard. They go, so you still out with Maynard? I go, no, you know. Yeah, they, you know, companies like that you're on the road touring. They like that. But so I... You know, no, I, you know, I actually quit that 3 years ago. So word travels slow sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
But 15 years, part of it was I wanted to be home a little more for my daughter at that point.
Yeah.
I just felt like that was important at the time. And it was a good time to leave. It felt like we were kind of duplicating things. We had gone to Christmas tours, which were great. A couple of Christmas albums with Brian Setzer. It was great.
That band was that was a very influential band and influenced a lot of the, that was that time period back then, early 2000s, where there was all those other big bands that were coming out. And right now I can't think of a name of one of them, but you know what I mean? There was a bunch of, there was a bunch of them that came out.
Yeah. And some of them actually, because of us, you might think of them, they were big bands, but they weren't big bands, but they were swing, like
swing, yeah.
Royal Crown Review.
That's what I mean.
Daniel Glass.
Right.
On drums,
yes.
Big Bad Voodoo Daddy,
right.
And there's three horns.
Swing
but the
band.
Impression
yeah.
is that it's the swing movement.
Yes.
And they would wear zoot suits and
right.
this kind of thing, Big Bad Voodoo Daddy. There was Squirrel Nut Zippers, where
right.
they were a little more, I think they had accordion, a little more intimate, but known for some videos. Maybe one more band, so I can't think who that was. But
okay. when
Brian was the big king of the swing as we were on the cover of Downbeat Magazine, which is jazz magazine.
Right.
We're not really playing jazz,
right?
But we're big band, and so he got the cover of Downbeat, and so he was the king, really, of all those bands. And some of it was because of this, how good it was, but how the size of the band, but also that he was already a known entity from the Stray Cats. So. Yeah, so he was kind of the leader of that per se,
yeah.
But we might have been the only real big band. Yeah,
well, like you said earlier, I mean, aspects of jazz, all the different aspects
right.
of jazz, right? So
right.
there's just so many yeah. aspects.
Yeah. Yeah, horns, swing feel, to a point, and
yeah.
The look of the band. But now, at the beginning of that band, you know, they talk about, okay, how can is Brian going to afford to take a big band out on the road,
right,
and do that at the beginnings of it, you know? And they go, well, let's, or maybe we could get horn players in different towns, right, and just bring rhythm section, meaning bass and drums, and a lead trumpet. That's maybe like what some people might do, like Johnny Mathis or whatever might do something that he'll bring his own rhythm section. And then, okay. And then Brian said, no, I want a band. I want everyone to be a band. I don't want rehearsals of guys just reading charts in front of an audience. And so with that actual thing, guys there all the time, meaning the horn players, 13 horns, they started doing goofs of moving their horns, swinging their horns, doing different moves a la 1940s big bands. That was the pop music of the day. The manager would go, hey, keep that in. You know that the thing where you're with your trumpets where it looks like you're doing curls, lifting weights?
Yeah.
Yeah, do that. And so, like, that's the thing. Once you do a goof and people go, yeah, keep doing it. Now you're stuck with it. Now you got to keep doing it. It's part of the act. It's like the Beatles going, woo! Yeah, you got to keep doing it. It's part of the act. So the horns doing horn moves also made it more than jazz and more than a big band. Normal big band from the, you know, that it was about the show too, and sure, movement, choreography, not dance, but choreography of horn movements. Yeah.
So I want to move on to some TV and film stuff, but
okay,
before we get into that, I want to talk to you a little bit about your approach to playing naturally and making it feel great when you're playing with click, because there's something to that, and you know, you're one of the greats at that, and it, being a session player, and bringing a natural feel, so you really aren't even knowing a click is there. Talk about that and your approach.
Mm-hmm. Well, playing with that natural fluid feel also without a click. First, it's got to start with that right. You know, sometimes people go, Bernie, you look so relaxed and fluid, you know, and I take that as a compliment, that, you know, that almost like Tai Chi movements of the, you know, of the, I'm doing it. We're doing audio only, but, you know, moving your arms in a fluid way and your technique, you know, like even my grip. You know, I kind of think grip is a misnomer, you know, and I used to grip the sticks, and that could lead to calluses, you know, or blisters, and a more tension kind of approach from your hands. And that, you know, I really like that video of that Jojo Mayer, you know, I'm promoting his stuff, but it's so good, his video on hands.
Yeah.
And different ways of, you know, fluidity and playing. And the thing that I think is that I'm barely holding the sticks. I'm almost like juggling them in the air.
Oh.
I'm holding them at the fulcrum.
Right.
You know, meaning that's where it is. And the other stuff is moving, and the stick's moving in my hand, left hand, traditional grip, and right hand, that I'm not gripping anymore. I remember a book when I was young. It was about, okay, wrist movement, arms, you know, fingers, but finger control. Maybe it was called finger control. I don't know. And I'm thinking, I'm gripping the right hand stick, match grip, and if the stick is there, and okay, now just use your fingers. I go, just use my fingers. The stick, I'm holding onto the stick. It won't move. And so I realized over time that I have to like be juggling the sticks, and they actually could fly out of my hand if I bump sticks together or hit a rim accidentally, because I'm not holding them. I'm almost like bouncing a basketball.
Yeah.
You're not holding the stick. You're not holding the ball. You're controlling it and playing with it.
Yeah, well, you're letting the stick do the work, and you're managing the weight and the rebound.
And then obviously, here's a big one: if you use traditional grip, your fulcrum is in the same place in both hands. But I can't visually show you, but the fulcrum, the fingers in the left hand traditional grip, are in front of the fulcrum towards the bead.
Right.
In your right hand or match grip, your fingers are behind the fulcrum going towards the butt end of the stick.
Ah.
So someone with a left-hand traditional grip, can look at my videos or whatever, but also Buddy or Louis Belton or whatever, you see all this stick behind their left hand because the fingers are in front of the fulcrum. So I used to go where I could see the same amount of stick behind each hand, but that's incorrect. Like that fulcrum is too far back in the left hand to do that. You have to move it up the stick. Really, if you have a Vic Firth stick, it's the fulcrum's pretty much right near that darn flag that's on the stick.
Okay.
Maybe a hair in front of it, just a hair towards the bead. And that lets the stick do the work, that when you just hold the stick only, no fingers on it, just by the fulcrum, the stick should fall forward a little bit. So you're getting help from the stick going towards the head. But if you hold too far back, it'll definitely go towards the head and fall forward, but too hard to bring the stick back up.
Right.
So that's important to me as far as fluidity there. So now back to the click. All right. So being relaxed on the click. So, it's just playing to a metronome. But generally, I was guilty of it. Many drummers, as they're trying to play to the click, play in front of the click, meaning you're getting there sooner. So and if you could get there different amounts of sooner, and that, like, if you play a fill, you quote unquote rush it, you're ahead of the click, and then your fill's over, and now you've got to pull back and slow down, basically. And somebody hearing you play with not hearing the click, they're going to hear, why does he slow down after he plays a fill? They might not even hear the fill rushing, because, rushing isn't like, if you don't have a click, it's not the end of the world. It's like the heart, when we get excited as a human, our heart speeds up. So it is kind of a human thing to speed up if we're excited, right, or slow down if we're relaxed.
That's a good point.
So, So that's not unusual for us humans, darn humans. But when you're playing to a click, it's a rigid thing. So I think most would agree then, is to get behind the click. So as you would want to rock, that you come up to the click and hit it and then go, I can't go any further, I got to stay behind it. So I think it's easier to say just a hair behind that click than a hair in front of it. It's like hair in front of it, the horsey's already out of the barn and we'll keep going. But if the horsey, this is for the kids. If you're up against that fence, the horsey can't get through it, and you go, that's where I have to stop, then that's a good place to be, behind the click. So you practice playing behind the click, like way too far behind the click.
Yeah.
Go, okay, I can do that. Now I'm going to move it up closer and see where that is.
Yeah.
Also, playing at different tempos. I mean, it sounds like a cliche, but people got to learn different keys when they're playing melodically. But drummers, we have to learn different tempos, not just 80, 120, and 160. You're slow, medium, and fast. Like if somebody counts off 164 and you've only played at 160 a lot, you're going to naturally want to get up to 60, 164, where your muscle memory is. So to practice at different tempos with and without clicks, different tempos, I mean, not 163, 164, 165, but at least every four, kind of thing, that you can live at different grooves, at different tempos, and get muscle memory on these things. But then playing to that click, playing nice and relaxed, but staying behind it. The other thing too, you play with an orchestra. Like when we do movies and TV, there's, you know, 60-piece orchestra, 30, 40-piece orchestra. They tend to, they don't want to be the first one in the pool. Like when a conductor goes, gives their downbeat, like without a click, it always looks like the orchestra is behind and the conductor's ahead, because nobody wants to anticipate and be early. So they all wait to make sure they see that downbeat. So, and they're a hair behind it, the reaction, and then they're all together behind it. So they kind of play that way with the click too. And so you can't be the one just consistently a hair ahead of the click, even though rhythm section players, bass, guitar, keyboard, they might naturally do that thinking, I'm anticipating, I'm going to be right on the click. When it's horns and strings, et cetera, they're going to be consistently a hair behind the click. And so as a rhythm section player, drummer, you want to play with them, not be what people hear is like, wow, that drum sound edgy. Like he's in front of the, doesn't feel that good. Yeah. It's in front of the click. So, and if anything, you go, oh, I want the drums to lay back on this ballad. Now, if the sound laid back, something has to be even further behind to sound even more relaxed. So if I play a ballad, for instance, I'm looking to aim the snare and the kick a hair behind the hi-hat. So people will go, how do I do that? You know? So I think a good little trick when you play, you're playing hi-hat eighth notes, click, 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 or even quarter notes, click, click, click. And then the snare, click, blah, is I try to play, if I'm playing right-hand hi-hat, left-hand snare, I try to play a left-hand flam.
Oh.
And the quote of going, that's where that should fall. Play a left-hand flam and you'll get click, blah, click, blah. Okay. And the question is how tight that flam is. You want it pretty tight and it'll still sound laid back then. So that's kind of a good way to start to get used to laying back a snare drum is learn to play a left-hand flam where your left hand is high, the right hand is low on the hat, the left hand is high in the air, getting ready to hit the snare, and the hi-hat will hit before the snare. That's really what's happening when you lay back the snare against the hat.
Okay.
But then the whole thing, are you laying back that whole thing now against the click? That means the hi-hat is right close to that click, burying it, you might say, not ahead of it. If anything, you're going to be a hair behind it. And then the snare even a little further back from there. And then that would be something you learn to do with the kick too, even though we're not used to playing flams with our a hand and a foot. Yeah.
Oh, that's really interesting. That's an interesting approach to that. So you've worked, all these different film scores that you've worked on. I'm just curious in some of your favorite composers that you've worked with. Mm-hmm. I know that I also know that you did that the Man of Steel soundtrack with all those guys, which was, I want to hear your thoughts on that session. That was an iconic session, but do you have some favorite composers you've worked with and also how they interpret rhythm and everything?
You know, and the fear is you leave one of your favorites out and they go, hey, Bernie, what about me? What am I, chopped liver? But you try to remember, you know, who's your favorite bass player? So, you know, I've done a lot with Michael Giacchino.
Yeah.
So a favorite thing about him is that he's so relaxed and willing to have fun as opposed, because there's a lot riding on, you know, getting it done quick enough and the budget and the director's there. And a sense that, wait, are you having fun here or are you being professional and serious about this? We got, you know, 100 million riding on this thing, you know. So, but he managed to do a good job of keeping things relaxed and fun and getting things done quickly. And one of his strengths is that he can also change it totally up from movie to movie. Or he did Lost, the TV show Lost, but he can change things up sound wise. Orchestration wise, feel wise, where he could sound like a totally different composer. Now, so that's been fun. Like to do like Zootopia, he asked me to do, Bernie, you got an all metal drum set. And he goes, not heavy metal, but actually metallic sound.
Yeah.
And of course, the answer is, yes, I do. Even if you've never done that before in your life. Right. And then you put it together. Okay, what am I going to have here? Okay, like a wash basin for a bass drum. And then, yes, I could have metal things, garbage cans, et cetera, whatever, gas cans. But then I'm thinking, what if he hates the metal? Or the director goes, can it sound more like drums? And here you are with all this metal around you.
Yeah.
And the director's going, can we get real drums on it instead while the 60-piece orchestra, 80-piece orchestra is waiting for you to switch a drum set out?
Right, right.
No, they're not. That's too much money being spent by the minute. So I put cymbals on the drums, on the toms, and snares, different snares. I had cymbals on them or a metal thing on them that I could quickly pull it off, and there's drums. You know, and I didn't have to do that for that, but I had to be ready for that. So, or one cue, we want it to be drums. There's not time like old school record day to, okay, let's change out the kick drum, you know? So, I recently had to recreate some Zootopia, sounds where I go, okay, I better set up a real bass drum too, in case they want to go. I had it ready to swap out. The one thing I didn't for Zootopia, but then I set it up like a double bass drum to have it as an option. Well, then another time Michael goes, okay, can you, you know how you did all metallic? Well, can you do something else weird that's not just metallic? I go, yes, I can. So I had like a, whatever, 65-gallon rubber tub, what are they called, barrel, and put it on its side with a one, you know, just one side and open on the other for a bass drum. I used a gong bops cajon for a secondary bass drum with a pedal. I used some ANF pancake snares that are like 1.5 inch deep and made those my toms with snares, or turned the snares off either one that were real like flat, 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 flat. Some different Sabian weird cymbals. Even some, what's the word? Keplinger cymbals that were just, you know, garbage, you know, no lathing, just flat piece of metal, dumb metal, and some different things. Oh yeah, 65 gallon, I forget how many gallon drum, metal drum, or I would play that. And even rubber buckets to play. And so I had this big setup for Spider-Man. So we did a couple of Spider-Man movies with Michael. And so it's even a bigger, more, you know, Neil Peart looking setup than Zootopia looked kind of contained without the metal. This was more options. And some, what was I going to say about the, and so I'm not going to hit everything on every cue. Or maybe I go, what about this? He goes, no, what else? He goes, can you use that with brushes instead? Or, no, okay, go to all buckets on this cue.
Yeah.
You know, so I had options, you know, to play and what would work. So anyway, Michael's very good about some different things. And so like, or we did Incredibles 2, and that was Gordon Goodwin doing some orchestration and arranging on that. And so real big bandy spy sounding, and Wayne Bergeron on lead trumpet, and me getting a, you know, rock out in 7 or whatever on the drums, and some fast fun fills or whatever. So sometimes the drum set in a movie needs to not sound like drums. So that's sure. Where that metal or the Spider-Man kit I developed is almost more percussion-y.
Yeah.
And not in a percussion sense like bongos and congas, but sounds that aren't drums, but you're playing drum set parts on them. Hans Zimmer is another, you know, iconic composer, that he has a sound, and he's done many of the, you know, what do you call it? Like that. We did, what was it? Man of Steel, it was called. Yeah, where it was the 12 drummers in a circle, and they recorded us in surround sound, and we all played the same stuff, same things, pretty much. Sometimes we experimented, one guy trying something, and then we'd answer it, and then maybe they cut it up and use some of that. But it was about that in the theater, you would all, instead of the music just coming stereo from the front and all the sound effects coming around you in the theater, that the music actually was surround sound too of the drummers. Like you might hear me in the right back speaker, hear Matt Chamberlain in the front left speaker, Sheila E. another spot, Vinny Colaiuta, center right, John Robinson. So all my, you know, heroes and peers getting to play with them and have fun like that. So
yeah,
almost drum corps like in a sense, okay. You know, not style, but that we're all playing the same thing there.
Yeah.
And then the next time for Batman versus Superman, he goes, okay, so Hans, okay, let's change it up. Same idea, but let's do eight drummers, but not in surround sound circle. We don't want that. We want it in stereo across the front, but actually eight spots of drums. So probably my guess is a director, they're going, no, we don't want that darn music competing with our blasts, sound effects blasts going off in the back or the overhead center. So we want the music contained to the front. So maybe that's why. Or he just likes to change it up, movie to movie. You know, there's part of that too. You know, there's a thing to get different sounds. Like when Michael would do the Planet of the Apes movies. All right, there's no drum set. I'm out in those. That's one of my strengths. I can be drum set cues, like on Family Guy too, for half the time or two cues only, and the other 28 cues out in the percussion section playing hand percussion or orchestral snare drum or metal omklongs, you know, different weird instruments too.
So, you know, speaking of percussion, I want to talk about your gombops instruments that you use.
Well, obviously the congas, I have two of the different lines. Do they say what they are? They're like, here's the gombop bongos here. What is, does it say what they are? They're solid state North American red oak.
California series.
Yeah, California, but there's another series too. It's a darker color too. Anyway, so I would rather play my newer gong box. One of the reasons, because it's apples versus oranges, is my old 1975 gong box, even though they're classic and they sound great, they have the original skin heads on them.
Yeah.
I never changed them out. So maybe they're too dead, the heads. Or can they last that long? Those heads from 1975 to now?
Actually, my gombops from back then, I have the original heads on them too. I don't have the heart to change them. There's something that I like about that sound for specific things, you know, but I don't take them out very often.
So these newer ones have that Remo, or made by Remo for gombops? Is that what it's?
Yep.
And what's the name of the head?
Those are Remo New Skin.
Okay. Now these aren't skin. Well, I want to change those heads out 45 years from now when I'm 110?
Maybe.
or, you know, it's interesting, like James Gadsden, drummer.
Right.
You know, okay, I go to hear him play. I go, oh, he's got DW drums there. You know, I play Krabby. I say, DWs. And I go up to look at his drums, and the heads, the drums are pretty new. The heads are really old.
Oh, yeah.
So I think what he did, he took old heads and put them on the new drums. Not to save money.
Right.
He liked that sound.
Yeah.
Now, there's nothing like fresh heads on, you know, when I go, okay, especially if you're beating them up and pocking them up where they start to stretch and maybe get dimply and then now they're rattling funny. Or you crank them up, now they need to crank them more. Now it's deader because the head has been stretching over the years. So there's a reason to change out heads, of course. But, you know, the heads on congas and bongos, you know, they're going to be tighter than a lot of drum sets, especially tom heads. They're going to be looser. So the looser a head is, the more it gets beat up, too. Yeah.
Bernie, man, thank you. This is so great to have you on the show.
All right. I'm glad I wore a nice shirt with the big B on the front for Brooklyn Dodgers and part of the BBB.
You did. Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Rich, for the time. I've enjoyed talking with you, and I hope I've given some tips and info and entertainment for today.
Absolutely fantastic. Thank you, man. Thank you, everybody, for joining us today on this episode. And there'll be future episodes coming up. Stay tuned on all of our social media for future announcements. Take care, everybody. We'll be in touch soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.